3 days later, Penrod stepped off the fast steamer at the Aswan jetty. He was wearing tropical khaki uniform without decorations or regimentals. He had exchanged the busby for a pith helmet with a wide brim. There were at least another 50 soldiers and officers within sight who were dressed almost identically, so he excited no attention. A ragged porter in a filthy turban seized his kit bag and ran ahead of him into the maze of streets of the old town. Striding out on long legs, Penrod kept him in sight. When they reached the gate in a nondescript mud wall at the end of the narrow, twisted alley, Penrod tossed the porter a piastre and retrieved his bag. He tugged the bell cord and listened to the familiar chimes. After a while, there were footsteps beyond the gate, soft and faltering, and a voice quavered, "Who is it that calls? There is nothing here, for we are poor widows and deserted by God." "Open this gate, you houri of paradise," Penrod replied, "and swiftly before I kick it down." There was a moment's stunned silence, broken at last by a wild cackle of laughter and of fumbling at the bolts. Then they were shot back and the gate creaked open. An ancient head, like a turtle's, but partly covered with a widow's veil, peered round the jamb. The gaping grin exposed two crooked teeth widely separated by an expanse of pink gum. "Effendi!" the old woman squealed, and her entire face puckered with wrinkles. "Lord of a thousand virtues!" Penrod embraced her. "You are shameless," she protested with delight. "You threaten my virtue." "I am 50 years too late to pluck that fruit." He let her go. "Where is your mistress?" Old Liala glanced significantly across the courtyard. In the centre of the garden, a fountain splashed into a pool in which Nile perch circled tranquilly. Around its border stood statues of the pharaohs, Seti, Thutmose, and great Ramesses, lifted from their tombs by grave robbers back in the mists of time. It never failed to amaze him that such treasures were displayed in so humble a setting. Penrod strode across the courtyard. His heart beat faster. He had not realized until that moment how much he had been looking forward to seeing her again. When he reached the beaded curtain that covered the doorway, he paused to regain his composure, then jerked it aside and stepped through. At first she was merely a dim, ethereal presence, but then his eyes adjusted and her shape emerged from the cool gloom. She was slim as a lily stem, but her robe was shot with gold thread, and there was gold at her wrists and ankles. As she came towards him, her bare, henna-painted feet made no sound on the tiles. She stopped in front of him and made obeisance, touching her fingertips to her lips and her heart. "Master," she whispered, "master of my heart." Then she hung her head and waited in silence. He lifted the veil and studied her face. "You are beautiful, Bakita," he told her, and the smile that blossomed over her features enhanced that beauty 100-fold. She lifted her chin and looked at him, and her eyes glowed so that they seemed to light the dimmest recesses of the room. "It has been only 26 days, but it seems like all my life," she said, and her voice quivered like the strings of a lute plucked by skilled fingers. "You have counted the days?" he asked. "And the hours also," she nodded. Roses coloured the waxen perfection of her cheeks, and the long lashes meshed over her eyes as she glanced away shyly. Then her eyes crept back to his face. "You knew I was coming," he accused her. "How could you, when I did not know it myself?" "My heart knew, as the night knows the coming of the dawn." She touched his face, as though she were blind and trying to remember something with her fingertips. "Are you hungry, my lord?" "I am famished for you," he replied. "Are you thirsty, my lord?" "I thirst for you as a traveller thirsts for the waterhole when he has been hunting 7 days in the desert under the relentless sun." "Come," she whispered and took his hand. She led him into the inner room. There Angareb stood in the centre of the floor, and he saw that the linen upon it had been washed, bleached, and smoothed with a hot iron, until it shone like the salt pan of Shokra. She knelt before him and removed his uniform. When he stood naked, she rose and stepped back to admire him. "You bring me vast treasure, lord." She reached out and touched him. "An ivory scepter, tipped with the ruby of your manhood." "If this is treasure, Then show me what you bring in exchange. Naked, her body was moon-pale and her breasts bulged weightily, the nipples as large as ripe grapes, wine-dark and swollen. She wore only a slim gold chain around her waist, and her belly was rounded and smooth as polished granite from the quarries above the first cataract. Her hands and feet were decorated with fine acanthus-wreathed patterns of henna. She shook out the dark tresses of her hair and came to lie beside him on their mattress. He gloated over her with his eyes and fingertips, and she moved softly as his hands dictated, raising her hips and twisting her shoulders so that her bosom changed shape and no secret part of her body was hidden from him. "Your quimi is so beautiful, so precious, that Allah should have set it in the forehead of a ravening lion. Then only the valiant and the worthy might dare to possess it." There was wonder in his voice. "It is like a ripe fig, warmed in the sun, splitting open and running with sweet juices." "Feast to your heart's content upon the fig of my love, dear lord," she whispered huskily. Afterwards they slept entwined, and their own sweat cooled them. At last old Liala brought them a bowl of dates and pomegranates and a jug of lemon sherbet. They sat cross-legged on the angareb, facing each other, and Bakita made her report to him. There was much for her to relate, great and dire news from the south, from Nubia and beyond. The Arab tribes were all in a state of flux and change, new alliances forged and century-old ties broken. At the centre of all this turmoil sat the Mahdi and his Khalifa, two venomous spiders at the centre of their web. Bakita was older than Penrod by 3 years. She had been the first wife of a prosperous grain merchant, but she was unable to bear him a child. Her husband had taken a younger woman to wife, a dull-witted creature with broad childbearing hips. Within 10 months she had given birth to a son. From this position of marital power she had importuned her husband. He had tried to resist her, for Bakita was clever and loyal with her business acumen. He had doubled his fortune in 5 short years. However, in the end, the mother of his son had prevailed. Sorrowfully, he had broken the dreadful words, "Talak, talak, talak. I divorce thee." Thus, Bakita had been cast into that terrible limbo of the Islamic world, inhabited only by widows and divorced women. The only paths that seemed open to her were to find an old husband with many wives who needed a slave without having to pay the head price, or to sell herself as a plaything to passing men. But she had honed the wiles of a merchant while serving her husband. With the few coins she had saved, she bought shards of ceramics and chipped damaged images of the ancient gods from the Bedouin and from the orphans who scratched in the ruins, the dry riverbeds and the nullahs of the desert, then sold them to the white tourists who came up the river on the steamers from the delta. She paid a fair price, took a modest profit, and kept her word. So soon the diggers and grave robbers brought her porcelain and ceramics, religious statuettes, amulets and scarabs, that after 4,000 years were miraculously perfect. She learnt to decipher the hieroglyphics of the ancient priests on these relics and the writings of the Greeks and Romans who came long after them. Alexander and the Ptolemy dynasty, Julius Caesar and Octavian, who was also Augustus. In time, her reputation spread wide. Men came to her little garden to trade and to talk. Some had travelled down the great river from as far afield as Equatoria and Suakin. With them they brought news and tidings that were almost as precious as the trade goods and the relics. Often the men talked more than they should have, for she was very beautiful and they wanted her. But they could not have her. She trusted no man after what the man she had once trusted had done to her. Bakita learnt what was happening in every village along the course of the great river and in the deserts that surrounded it. She knew when the sheikh of the Jalin Arabs raided the Bisharin, and how many camels he stole. She knew how many slaves Zubayr Pasha sent down to Khartoum in his dhows, and the taxes and bribes he paid to the Egyptian governor in the city. She followed intimately the intrigues of the court of Emperor John in High Abyssinia and the trade manifests in the ports of Suakin and Aden. Then one day a small ragged urchin came to her with a coin wrapped in a filthy rag that was like no coin she had seen before or since. It filled the palm of her hand with the weight of fine gold. On the obverse was the portrait of a crowned woman, and on the reverse a charioteer wearing a laurel wreath. The surfaces were so pristine that they seemed to have been struck the previous day. She was able to read the legend below each portrait readily. The couple on the coin were Cleopatra, Thea, Philopeta, and Marcus Antonius. She kept the coin and showed it to no one, until one day a man came into her shop. He was a Frank, and for a while she was speechless, for in profile he was the image of the Antony on her coin. When she recovered her tongue, they talked for a while with Paquita, veiled, and old Liala sitting in close attendance as chaperone. The stranger spoke beautiful poetic Arabic, and soon he did not seem to be a stranger. Without knowing it, she began to trust him a little. "I have heard that you are wise and virtuous, and that you may have items to sell that are beautiful and rare," he asked at last. She sent Liala away on some pretext, and when she poured another thimble of thick black coffee for her guest, she contrived to let her veil slip so that he could glimpse her face. He started and stared at her until she readjusted it. They went on speaking, but something hung in the air like the promise of thunder before the first winds of the Khamsin. Paquita was gradually overtaken by an overpowering urge to show him the coin. When she placed it in his hand, he studied the portraits gravely, then said, "This is our coin, yours and mine." She bowed her head in silence, and he said, "Forgive me, I have offended you." She looked up at him and removed the veil so he could look into her eyes. "You do not offend me, Effendi," she whispered. "Then why do your eyes fill with tears?" "I weep because what you said is true, and I weep with joy." "You wish me to leave now?" "No. I wish you to stay as long as your heart desires."
"That may be a long time."
"If it is God's will," she agreed. In the years that followed that first meeting, she had given him everything that it was in her power to give, but in exchange had asked from him nothing that he would not give freely. She knew that one day he would leave her, for he was young and came from a world where she could never follow him. He had made her no promise. At their first meeting he had said, "That may be a long time," but he had never said, "always." So she did not try to exact a pact from him. The certainty of the ending added a poignancy to her love that was sweet as honey and bitter as the wild melon of the desert. This day she sat with him and told him all she had learnt since they had last spoken 26 days before. He listened and asked questions, then wrote it all out on 5 pages from his dispatch notebook. He did not need to consult a cipher, for he had learnt by heart the code that Sir Evelyn Baring had given him. Old Liala covered her head with her widow's cloak and slipped out into the alley, carrying the dispatch tucked into her intimate undergarments. The sergeant of the guard at the British military base knew her as a regular visitor. He was under strict orders from the base intelligence officer, so he personally escorted her to the headquarters building. Within the hour, the message was buzzing down the telegraph line to Cairo. The following morning it had been deciphered by the signals clerk at the consulate, and the en clair text was on the consul general's silver tray when he came in from breakfast. Once she had sent Liala to the base with the report, Paquita came back to Penrod. She knelt beside his stool and began to trim his sideburns and moustache. She worked quickly, and with the expertise of long practice, had soon reduced his fashionable whiskers to the ragged shape of a poor Arab fella. Then she turned to his dense wavy curls, and the tears slid down her cheeks as she hacked them away. "They'll soon grow again, my dove," Penrod tried to console her, as he ran his hand over the stubble.
"It is like murdering my own child," she whispered. "You are so beautiful."
"And I will be beautiful again," he assured her. She gathered up his uniform from where it lay in the corner of the room.
"I will not let even Liala touch it. I will wash it with my own hands," she promised him. "It will await your return, but never as eagerly as I."
Then she brought the cloth bag in which she had kept his stained and ragged clothing from his last journey to the south. She wound the filthy turban round his cropped head. He strapped the leather purse round his waist and tucked the service revolver into the light canvas holster. then slipped the curved blade of the dagger into its sheath beside the Webley. They would not show under his dirty galabeah. Then he strapped on a pair of rough camel-hide sandals and was ready to leave. "Stay with God, honoured lady," he bowed obsequiously, and she was amazed at how easily he had made the transformation from swaggering hussar to humble peasant, from effendi to fella.
"Return to me soon," she murmured, "for if you perish, I shall perish with you."
"I shall not perish," he promised.